Welcome to the Environmental Law Monitor. I am your host, Daniel Pope. This podcast is brought to you by Bracewell LLP's Environment, Lands, and Resources Group, and we're glad you're tuning in. If you're joining us for the first time from our website, do know that you can subscribe via any of the podcast streaming services like Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and others. If you'd like to leave a review, please do so, but let's keep in mind mom's advice to, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. I'm joined today by Brittany Pemberton, an associate in our DC office, my personal mentor and life coach, et cetera, et cetera. And Brittany, before we actually discuss anything related to environmental law or what we actually do to make a living, I've just got to say this, and this might be dated by the time this podcast actually reaches our dear listeners, but that was a wild Formula One race in Saudi Arabia over the weekend. And you've been following the sport a lot longer than I have. I'm one of these new Netflix Drive to Survive guys. But even to me, it seems like that was probably one of the wildest races in F1 history. Your thoughts?
Yeah, wild is one way to put it. And, there's no shame in being a Drive to Survive guy. I got to say that Formula One management and Liberty Media has done a great job in attracting new, younger, much bigger generation of hopefully fans that are going to stick with the sport for a long time, which is something that sport desperately needed. So I'm all for Drive to Survive. But yeah, that was kind of a crazy race. I'm hoping that they FIA take a close look at the situation and try to sort through some of the ramifications when it comes to when do we go for safety car versus virtual safety car versus red flagging a race, because, maybe a little bit of inconsistency in the response to some of the incidents that came up throughout the course of the race led to some crazy results, I think, in terms of some team strategy. I'm a huge McLaren fan, and it was just a sad, sad day for Lando Norris, who'd qualified so well, but then jumped into the pit to change his tires under that first safety car, which is what you do when a safety car comes out, and then just never recovered because the red flag came out, not too much longer after that. And then
you could have had a free tire change.
Yeah, exactly. So, a lot of people had their races kind of scuttled for that reason. And then, obviously huge drama between Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen.
Our championship contenders.
Now, totally even going into the final race of the season. It's been an incredible season, right? I mean, so exciting. The lead has changed a number of times. And obviously, emotions are high between them,
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. I was asking you, is every F1 season like this? And then you emphasized that definitely not. Hopefully the entertainment keeps up. And I think by the time this airs, we're most likely going to have clarity. I mean, I hope we have clarity on who's going to be the next champion in the Formula One Drivers' Championship. So I'm not going to ask you to make a prediction about who that's going to be, unless you want to offer one. I mean, we could probably talk a lot about Max Verstappen, Lewis Hamilton, Red Bull, Mercedes, and the stewards, that like mysterious Lord of the Ringsy sounding group of people that make big decisions about that. And maybe, you and I could even start like a niche Bracewell podcast about that. But let's turn to what we are actually here to discuss and what the people want. And that's a really interesting grant of cert from the United States Supreme Court in a dispute over the scope of Section 111D of the Clean Air Act. I know you've been following disputes over what Section 111D authorizes EPA to do. And I know that many others in the firm have been following this more closely. I mean, this cert grant, full disclosure, kind of caught me off guard because this relates to the Clean Power Plan history. This relates to the Trump administration's Affordable Clean Energy Rule. And from the cheap seats where I sit, I knew that the DC Circuit had struck down the Trump administration's Affordable Clean Energy Rule. I think that was earlier this year. And so I had assumed that the current administration would just sort of go on with rulemaking as normal. And then this cert grant happens, and now I'm confused. So I'm looking to you to help me understand it. Maybe you can fill in some of the gaps here. So what's been going on with 111D And what's the Supreme Court looking to review with this case? Get us started.
Yeah, so you're right. Lots of history here. You know, going back to the Obama administration in 2015, they issued the first ever regulations of greenhouse gas emissions for existing coal and natural gas fired power plants. That's what's called the Clean Power Plan. That rule was quite interesting because it took a different approach to 111D than really EPA had done in the past by coming up with three building blocks, EPA called it, that are different methods of emission reductions. Heat rate improvements, something that could be done at the facility, technological measures that actually improve efficiency, but then a couple of other things that are slightly more interesting, increased generation from...
The heat rate improvements... That seems like that's textbook Clean Air Act stuff that I remember from law school, right? You kind of focus on...
That's absolutely right. You know, 111D is about what emissions reductions can you achieve through the best system of emission reductions. And that typically is, you know, what controls can you put on at your plant? Can you... add on some kind of scrubber or something like that. And so that's kind of your what you'd expect.
Yeah. And so that to me, that seems kind of normal. Nothing seems weird about the Clean Power Plan, but I think you're about to get to the other two building blocks.
Yeah. So the other two building blocks are really where the money is, I think. And they kind of amount to this idea of generation shifting that the, you know, Clean Power Plan would drive the, power sector generally to increase generation from lower emitting natural gas plants and to prioritize zero emitting sources, you know, like solar and wind. And that idea of looking beyond the fence line of the plant itself is the thing that really caught a lot of attention when the Clean Power Plan came out. It drew, you know, litigation itself. The DC Circuit started to weigh in on all of that. The Supreme Court actually stayed the Clean Power Plan's implementation in February of 2016, even before the DC Circuit ever ruled, which was kind of an astonishing thing in and of itself. The DC Circuit ultimately never finished litigation on the Clean Power Plan because the administration changed and the Trump administration said, you know, we're actually going to take some further actions on these regulations and there's no need to carry forward with the litigation. So that takes us to the Affordable Clean Energy Rule under the Trump administration, or the ACE rule. And that's really what's at issue in the Supreme Court at this point in time is that early 2021, right after or right around inauguration, the D.C. Circuit in the American Lung Association case overturned the ACE rule. And there were two parts to that rule. One was a repeal of the Clean Power Plan. And, you know, EPA's rationale for why what the Obama administration had done was not lawful. A lot of that focused on this issue of going beyond the fence line. A couple of other legal issues in there, too, but that's kind of the main one. And then, you know, the second part of the ACE rule was really the Trump administration's replacement rule, which really did stick to the fence line energy efficiency kind of heat rate improvement reductions.
So it seems like what we're talking about is it's continued disputes over what the Clean Air Act allows EPA to do with respect to existing sources. And that's a central focus for making any kind of movement on reducing greenhouse gases. So that's a helpful background, a helpful explainer, probably the quickest and clearest explainer I've ever heard on the background of this litigation. I don't think in my world, I spend a lot of time tracking WOTUS and the Waters of the United States rule. And I don't think I could give as condensed a summary of litigation over that. So the Supreme Court granted cert in November or maybe in October. I remember texting you about that. I think like on a Friday evening or something. Whoa, did you just see what happened? What is the Supreme Court looking to review here? Because again, you know, it seems like the DC Circuit's decision that the ACE rule is invalid just sets us back to sort of square one. EPA can go ahead and try again to get 111D right as they try to regulate emissions from existing sources. So if the Trump rule is dead, why does the Supreme Court grant cert? What do they want to look at?
Yeah. And I think that's the most interesting question here is that you know, it caught a lot of people off guard. I think that the Supreme Court took this case because the rule is dead. And the Biden administration even asked the DC Circuit to stay its vacature of the ACE rule in order to make sure there was no way that the Clean Power Plan would spring back into effect while all of
like
this was...
Like a zombie Clean Power Plan?
Yeah, was being sorted out.
Like reanimated Halloween surprise.
Yeah, exactly. So there's the Clean Power Plan is not operating. It's not in effect. Nobody has to comply with that. And the, you know, net result of all of this litigation and of the rollback and everything is that there aren't any greenhouse gas emission regulations for existing fossil fuel fired power plants. So you would kind of think, okay, well, what's the problem here? So it's, you know, I think it's really clear that granting cert shows us that the Supreme Court is interested in trying to figure out what the boundaries are for 111D. Can, Section 111D of the Clean Air Act, can EPA look beyond the source itself? And then there are a couple of other legal doctrines that are potentially at play. The D.C. Circuit's opinion from earlier this year spent a lot of time on this issue of the major questions doctrine, which is, you know, courts are not supposed to defer to an agency's statutory interpretation in cases that have vast political or economic consequences. You know, there are a couple of permutations of that that you can see both in the D.C. Circuit opinion and in the cert petitions that were granted. You know, another one is this question of the clear statement rule. Courts are not supposed to interpret a statute in a way that brings vast consequences unless there's an unmistakably clear statement from Congress that it intended that result. And so the people that are challenging the result in the D.C. Circuit, you know, the vacature of the ACE rule, are making this point that, you know, the court got it wrong because the Clean Power Plan violated those legal doctrines. It would have vast political or economic consequences. There's no unmistakably clear statement from Congress that, you know, EPA is entitled to do what the challengers really describe as, you know, reordering the power sector, telling the entire industry how it's supposed to dispatch to the grid in a way that, you know, is kind of foreign when you compare it to those really standard controls that might be applied at the source, like EPA's done under other existing source standards under Section 111.
And so this case sort of presents a triple threat, in my view, using threat loosely, of course. But it's so we've got questions about what do you do with 111D? What does 111D actually authorize EPA to do? That's sort of the strict, you know, read the statute, what does it say question. I think then, and this is something we've seen from this particular court and from some of the recent nominees to the bench, what role does Chevron have to play when there's such a significant question presented when EPA acts in a certain way? And that's really why I think a lot of attention is going to be directed to this case outside of the environment and natural resources world, right? This is a question that deals pretty strictly with administrative law, and we're asking questions to some justices on the Supreme Court who have at various times in their, you know, in their tenure as judges on appellate courts or in other capacities have expressed some skepticism about Chevron. And then I think you were also getting at sort of the non-delegation doctrine. How much can Congress actually delegate to executive agencies, right, to shift lanes from Article I institutions of government to Article II institutions of government and kind of get away with it? What do they have?
Both admin law issues here and separation of powers concerns potentially.
Huge all over the place. Okay, well, so Brittany, when I took a look at the petitions for cert after I heard that cert had been granted, I wanted to peek. And it looks like a number of the petitioners, and there are four cases that are consolidated here, but a number of the petitioners really faulted the D.C. Circuit for not engaging with some of the sort of precedent from UARG that these are decisions of vast economic importance, and that they argue that the D.C. Circuit just didn't engage with these issues at all. So what did the D.C. Circuit do in its decision below on some of these topics you've just identified that are going to be significant for the Supreme Court as we work towards a decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think Judges Millett and Pillard would really disagree with that characterization of the, you know, cert petitioners. They really looked at a lot of that case law that's water under the bridge and sort of important precedent on those other legal doctrines. One of the things that the opinion clearly says is that, you know, each critical element of the agency's regulatory authority on going beyond the fence line on 111D has long been recognized by Congress and judicial precedent. There's no question that nationwide regulation of greenhouse gas emissions by power plants falls squarely within the EPA's wheelhouse. That's Massachusetts versus EPA. Yeah, exactly. Also, the AEP decision said that it's the agency's job to regulate power plant emissions of greenhouse gases under Section 111. On top of that, the issuance of regulations addressing greenhouse gas pollution is mandatory because of, you know, longstanding endangerment findings. Again, Massachusetts, there's no question here that EPA has made endangerment findings about greenhouse gas emissions, according to the D.C. Circuit anyway. That finding, even though it, you know, predates the Clean Power Plan, triggers a mandatory duty for EPA to regulate greenhouse gas pollution.
The DC Circuit, Trump administration had to come out with the ACE rule anyways, yeah, right?
The majority here thinks that that's not in question. You know, there is another, you know, legal argument there that maybe the endangerment finding prerequisite hasn't been met, but that's not in the question before the Supreme Court. Yeah, exactly. And that the pollution measures in the Clean Power Plan don't fit the major question mold, this issue of, you know, did Congress clearly state that EPA has the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants in a way that would have this vast economic significance? That's not this case doesn't fit that mold, according to the D.C. Circuit majority. They looked at Brown and Williamson, which is, you know, the seminal decision about whether the FDA could regulate tobacco products, and explain their
economic importance issue.
Yeah, that there's really a difference in that case and this one. You know, the FDA had never regulated any tobacco products at all, and the way that the agency would have regulated them would have actually been essentially a ban on tobacco products, and that's not what we have here. The Supreme Court has already explained that EPA can regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and it's clear that they can regulate power plants. It's just totally different than Brown versus Williamson, you know, according to the D.C. Circuit majority. And same goes for UARG. You know, the major question there was, who can EPA actually regulate? And the Supreme Court said that, you know, EPA statutory authority for, requiring permits for the construction of stationary sources was designed to apply to a relatively small handful of large sources and not, you know, millions of small sources of greenhouse gases that are not regulated. These sources aren't regulated for other pollutants. You know, you can't require Title V permits just because of greenhouse gas emissions alone. We don't have a question like that here of who EPA is regulating. They're not trying to reach beyond the power sector. They're trying to regulate the power sector, and that's what they're purporting to do.
The question is how they do it.
Yeah,
as opposed to weather in some ways.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, I think this is going to make for a pretty interesting case that touches on a lot of issues. I think that, you know, constitutional law nerds like myself, we'll be following it for some reasons. People who are really interested in administrative law will be following this case. And then, of course, people who have a particular interest in regulation of the power sector will obviously be following it. And I don't know, this could be sort of a blockbuster case, perhaps.
I mean, it's certainly going to be the biggest environmental case of the term, right?
Right.
And potentially the biggest case, you know, for the next 5-10 years. I don't even know. The biggest case since Massachusetts v. EPA.
Yeah. And I've been desperately searching for really interesting sort of blockbuster environmental cases at SCOTUS, as you know, to muse on and share thoughts on, because I enjoy doing that. I think we both have SCOTUS blog saved to our bookmarks bar on our browsers. But, you know, as our colleague Jeff Homestead has mentioned a few times, and I think this is really interesting, one of his observations was the shifting makeup of the Supreme Court is likely to be one of the Trump administration's most significant sort of regulatory reforms, because a lot of the perspectives that the new justices bring, an emphasis on statutory interpretation, a concern for separation of powers and the limits of executive power. We read about all of that stuff in nearly every rulemaking preamble that came out of the Trump administration's EPA and other agencies between 2016 and 2020. And that's sort of backstopped by this current version of the Supreme Court, which is now comprised of a number of judges or number of justices who look at statutory interpretation, the structure of the government that way. So that's pretty interesting to me. What do you think the timing is, though? We talked about how seems like kind of a last minute cert grant, at least for the current term. Is there any chance that like this case gets pushed into 2022?
I don't think so. I think a late October grant is really actually not too late to get it done. You know, a lot of people who know me know that one of my other areas that I spent a lot of time working on is the renewable fuel standard. Some of our listeners may know that there was a Supreme Court case decided in June of this year on some RFS issues. The cert grant in that case, I think, wasn't until January of 2021.
Oh.
And they pulled off the briefing in about 3 months. I mean, they argued the case very close to the reply brief in order to fit it in by the end of the term. But we have even a longer lead time here. It looks like merits briefs are due actually in the next week or so, the opening briefs. And then the whole thing should be briefed up by about mid-February. So the justices really could hear oral arguments, you know, starting the end of February if they wanted to. So I think that should give us plenty of time to get a decision in by June 30th.
Excellent. Well, there's a lot more that we could say about West Virginia versus EPA. And I suspect that as an oral argument data set, and we see this additional briefing, that we'll see more and more discussion of this case in the media and in the trade press. I'm pretty sure that by coming on this podcast, Brittany, you've implicitly promised to come back on and help us break down the opinion once we have one next summer.
I would love to do that, Daniel. And I also think one thing we may watch out for, you know, in between now and then is what is the Biden EPA going to do?
Right. With regulating talk about that really. Does this frustrate their planning?
Yeah, the administrator has been pretty firm in public remarks that they plan to move ahead with proposing something. That's obviously going to be tricky for them because they're not going to know what the scope of their regulatory authority is under Section 111D until probably June. And whatever remains is likely to be less than what this administration would want it to be. So they need to think of a way to put forward some options that are going to be resilient regardless of what the Supreme Court issues, I think.
Yeah, that's a totally interesting component of this. You know, the existence of this case and the fact that we're looking at a likely June opinion, unless there's just complete support for one side or the other, you know, what takes so long
for
these?
And there may be, I mean, given that it takes four votes to even grant cert, it may not be a huge stretch to think that there are five or six votes on a much narrower scope of 111D, whether that's just on, you know, a statutory interpretation basis or on some of these other broader legal doctrines that we talked about.
It'll be interesting to see if, you know, after the oral arguments are held and the Supreme Court goes into conference, if we get into that sort of opinion writing process where as one perspective or one interpretation of the statute actually gets fleshed out on the page by a justice who takes the lead pen on the majority opinion, if that justice's particular interpretation of 111D causes some of the votes that they had going into the opinion process to switch or to concur or something like that and fracture the decision from the court. And that could push it out a little bit later and we could be looking at a midsummer decision. But at any rate, we're glad that you have already promised to return to us and we appreciate that. And while I'm in an appreciative mood, I want to acknowledge and thank some of our team members at Bracewell who make the Monitor possible. Obviously, it's fun for the attorneys to hop on here and to share our thoughts about what's going on in the world of environmental and natural resources law and policy. But that doesn't just happen. I imagine most of our listeners have been on conference calls with some of our attorneys, and we can fidget with video and audio settings as we try to get those right. So you know that we're not the most tech savvy and we're not capable of producing this all by ourselves. We're wonderfully and ably assisted in the production of this podcast by Julia Bauman, Emily Korbrowski, and Dorn Pollard. They help us with recording and scheduling. And then our broader marketing team also helps to polish and promote the podcast as well. So many thanks to Julia, to Emily, to Dorn, and to the rest of our team for making this possible. And thanks most of all to you, our listeners. We're excited that our little podcast is helpful, and we always appreciate hearing from you. So please reach out, and we will talk to you soon. Happy holidays.